Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman and welcome to What Women Must Know. It's great having you join me today because these are wonderful shows that allow us to have in-depth conversations about topics that are so relevant for your health and well-being. And as always, getting empowered with truthful information will really allow you to make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. Before I jump into a fantastic show today, please remember to go to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, because you get special reports, you have access to all my free articles. It's a great educational website. And also, if you go over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, I do posts every day, usually several posts a day of great information, recipes, studies, just whatever takes my fancy that I think is really important for you to understand and add to your knowledge bank. So check it out and take advantage of all these wonderful avenues that are just going to fill you with more information, more understanding, and of course that's always going to lead you to be able to make great decisions for your health. So we're going to be exploring today the world of autoimmune diseases. So think about this. It is estimated that 25 million people now suffer from some sort of diagnosed autoimmune condition, such as MS, or perhaps rheumatoid arthritis, or like me, I had Hashimoto's thyroiditis, an autoimmune disease of your thyroid. And then there's an additional 50 million people who have headaches or pain, other conditions that have antibodies, but not really showing up seriously. So that's like 75 million people that are either on the verge or full-blown autoimmune diseases. And we're going to go in and share a few more stats with you as well. So we're going to be sharing with you how to heal MS and other autoimmune diseases naturally with my guest, Dr. Terry Walls. Now, this is a fantastic guest we're having today. Let me tell you a little bit about her. Dr. Terry Walls is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa, where she teaches internal medicine residents, sees patients in a traumatic brain injury clinic, and conducts clinical trials. She is also a patient with a chronic progressive neurological disorder, secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, which confined her to a tilt-recline wheelchair for 4 years. But thanks to the power of the Walls Protocol, which is based on functional medicine and the Walls Paleo Diet, Dr. Walls restored her health and now pedals her bike 5 miles to work each day. Hopefully not in the wintertime. She is also the author of The Walls Protocol, How I Beat MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine. So everyone, you are in for a most inspiring conversation today. So welcome, Dr. Terry Walls.
Oh, thank you. So glad to be here.
You didn't bicycle in your freezing winter weather, did you?
Oh, no. But soon, it's beginning April, the bike will be back out.
Well, I'm a biking enthusiast, so I totally understand. So I hope it thaws out soon, Terry. So let's talk about your journey. Let's first begin by your personal experience. What happened to you? And
sure.
Explain a little bit about that diagnosis of MS and how it affected you and why.
I'll start with the diagnosis of MS, then I'll quickly tell my story. In MS, the immune cells are no longer recognizing self appropriately and begin attacking the spinal cord and the brain. Now, we think it's primarily the myelin that is damaged, which is the insulation on the wiring connecting the brain cells. But over time, things begin to degenerate and the connective wiring breaks, and that's when the person switches over to the progressive phase of the disease. There's no longer periods of improvement, but instead just a steady decline. In my case, I was diagnosed in 2000 on the basis of left leg weakness, a history 13 years earlier of visual dimming, lesions on my spinal cord at the level of my neck, and abnormal spinal fluid. So I was told I had relapsing remitting MS. I went to the Cleveland Clinic to get a second opinion from one of the most premier MS centers in the country, and they agreed that I had relapsing remitting MS. I began taking daily injections of Copaxone. Within 3 years, though, my disease had transitioned to that progressive phase. I took mitoxantrone, which is a form of chemotherapy, and then I took Tysabri, which is that very pricey new drug that costs about $40,000 a year. But when that was pulled from the market, I was switched to Cellcept, another type of immune-suppressing drugs. Now, I'm going to back people up just a bit. In 2002, before I'd hit the wheelchair, my neurology doctor in Cleveland Clinic suggested that I look at some work by Ashton Embry, who had introduced me to Lauren Cordain and the paleo diet as a way of treating autoimmune conditions. I'd been a vegetarian for 20 years, and after reading, thinking about this deeply, I reintroduced meat back into my diet. I stopped grains, legumes, and dairy, but I'd continued to decline. So in 2003, I needed the wheelchair. And that's when I started reading the medical literature myself. I was reading mouse and rat studies for the mouse models for MS, Parkinson's, Huntington's disease, and dementia. And started identifying studies where the mouse brains had been protected using vitamins and supplements, so I was adding these. And, you know, after a few months, I thought I was wasting my money. I quit my vitamins and supplements and couldn't get out of bed. I was exhausted. A couple days later, my wife comes in, brings my vitamins in, and says, you know, honey, I think I ought to take these. I take them, and I could get up again and go back to work. And that was very exciting. And I thought, wow, you know, maybe they are doing something for me. But the scientist in me was curious, so 2 weeks later, I did the same thing, same result, and then I was exhilarated because now I felt like my reading, I could discover things that my physicians weren't telling me that would be helpful. So now I'm spending more time reading, adding a few more vitamins and supplements. I'm still declining, but it's clear to me that I'm declining at a slower rate. And so I'm really very, very grateful for that. The summer of 2007, I'm having problems with brain fog, losing my keys, losing my phones. My back has gotten further weak, so I can sit up for maybe 10, 15 minutes. If I go longer than that, I'm completely exhausted. So we have a zero-gravity reclining chair that I work from in my office, and another one that I have at home, or I'm in bed. And I can walk 25, 50 yards using two walking sticks. Otherwise, I'm in that tilt-recline wheelchair. That summer, I make two big discoveries. One is neuromuscular electrical stimulation, and I found that reviewing another research study. Got a physical therapist to give me a test session. I tolerate it. I begin training in clinic, and then he gets me a continuum device manufactured by EMPI, and I start training at home. So I do the e-stim while I'm doing some exercises. I also discover the Institute for Functional Medicine and take their course on neuroprotection, a functional medicine approach to common and uncommon neurological syndromes. It deepens my understanding of what I can do, and now I have a much longer list of vitamins and supplements that I take. And then later that fall, I have what I think is really probably the most brilliant idea, and that is that I should get this long list of nutrients, they're about 20, from the food that I eat, that if I do that, instead of relying on synthetic vitamins and supplements, I will get all the related compounds that are biologically active, plus thousands of compounds that haven't yet been named. So more research to figure this stuff out. But by December, I've got this new meal plan in place. And 1 month later, 2 months later, I'm able to walk using a cane between exam rooms. And 3 months later, I'm really feeling very comfortable. I'm beginning to walk without the cane, short distances. Within 6 months, I'm walking throughout the hospital without the cane. I get on my bike for the first time in about 5 years and bike around the block. My family and I were crying because we had all accepted that I would never be able to bike again. And now that's the first time I'm feeling comfortable that I don't know what the future is going to bring, that maybe I really could recover most of my function. And then at 9 months, I do an 18-mile bicycle tour with my family. And that's when my understanding of disease and health is really utterly transformed. The type of medicine I practice is transformed. I'm much more into functional medicine, diet and lifestyle. I begin lecturing the public. I identify some senior scientists to help me design a study protocol. We write a grant. I get funding, and we start October 2010 doing a clinical trial that tests my protocol in others with progressive MS. We've published the first paper out of that trial. And I'm now at my clinics at the VA hospital using functional medicine, diet and lifestyle interventions very successfully. And my clinicians, my colleagues at first a little upset, and then they get more and more comfortable as they see these really amazing results come through.
Are there stats about how successful people are in recovering from S in the manner you did?
So, when we looked through the using PubMed.gov, searching for case reports on progressive MS, secondary progressive or primary progressive, there are no other case reports of recovery of function to the degree that I have.
Wow.
So we have my report. I have a case series that I reported on, so that was the next paper we did. And then, of course, our clinical trial that we have that paper on as well. And as far as I know, primary progressive MS, there is no FDA-approved treatment protocols because no one has ever found any intervention that stops the decline. Although in my next paper, we'll be reporting, because we added primary progressive into our population, and so we'll be able to report on how we were able to slow their disease and make some very exciting changes for them as well.
So this is such a profound breakthrough that you had to discover and create for yourself, but you're now being able to share it and offer it to so many mm-hmm. people, and not just with MS, of course. This is
correct,
far bigger
correct.
Than that. I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were as to what conditions or exposures brought MS into your experience. What do you
okay.
think contributed?
You know, I talk about this in my book, so I lay out the story of my illness and what I think contributed to my becoming ill. So I have a family history for mental health issues with depression, some schizophrenia in the family. I have family history for autoimmune conditions, a lot of inflammatory bowel disease, and some early heart disease. So I probably have less efficient enzymes for metabolizing my B vitamins, how I metabolize and detoxify compounds.
Mm.
So that's my genetic risk there. Then I grew up in Iowa on a farm that was not organic. We were beginning to use atrazine and other herbicides on the farm. I helped my father deworm and delouse the hogs and the cattle.
Mm-hmm.
I am an artist, so I did a lot of painting with oil paints, acrylic paints, a lot of woodworking with solvents. I did metallurgy, so I was exposed to a lot of solder. During medical school, I got several silver fillings, and, of course, all the formaldehyde. And one summer, I stripped all of the woodworking in a condominium without adequate ventilation, so I got a lot of solvents there as well. So a lot of toxin exposure and less efficient enzymes for metabolizing those toxins. As a little girl, I was bottle-fed and then had recurrent tonsillitis, so I had a lot of antibiotics before the age of 5 and then had my tonsils removed. So probably killed off my healthy gut bacteria and probably had an overgrowth of yeast and candida. On top of that, leaky gut. And then developed gluten sensitivity. probably, you know, in early adolescence is my guess. Then, of course, during medical school, I listened to my advice when I said, be afraid of the sun, put on sunscreen, and made myself very vitamin D deficient for many, many years. During high school, decided to become a vegetarian for ethical reasons and was not on top of the issue with B12, had a starch-heavy diet, and was probably making myself B12 deficient, and was probably skewing my fatty acids far too strongly towards omega-6. So all of those things,
anything else?
All those things were sort of little problems for me that were not very helpful. Now there were some things that I did that were good. I did transcendental meditation through college. Quit during residency. I don't know why. I always ran a lot during college. Probably overtrained because I like to run about 80 miles a week. So that was a little excessive, and I did taekwondo and competed nationally. And so when I became ill, the one decision that I made that was very, very wise, I knew I had to work out every day to maintain my strength as long as possible. So I would lift weights, and then I walked on the treadmill. When I couldn't do that anymore, I put in a pool, and I did water aerobics and weightlifting using my pool.
You know, your story is really the story of, not in the exact way, but those underlying issues, the toxicity, genetic predispositions, the deficiencies, the stress, which had to have been part of it, just being in medical school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, this is what is driving the epidemic of chronic illness right now that's plaguing our culture, our society. And, you know, when I was reading your book, as you were talking about kind of undoing some of the programming that you were trained in, it was the realization that we name things. We like to name things. We name things Hashimoto's, we name things MS, we name it fibromyalgia, cardiovascular disease. But can you share, as you write so well in your book, why this is leading us down the wrong track for healing?
Yeah, well, you know, physicians have been classifying things as best we could based on physical findings. And so, you know, we'd get names, and then as we got more lab testing, we could get a few more names. And that allowed us to make predictions about how that disease would go and what drugs or interventions might be helpful. And so, you know, that was good. It made a lot of sense. But now that we can understand more thoroughly at the cell level and at the biochemical level, the changes that are going on, one of the things that we're discovering is often there's a problem with oxidative stress, meaning the mitochondria are not working very well. Then we have a problem with toxins making the symptoms worse, so the chemistry is getting poisoned and confused. So that seems to happen across many diseases. Then we have another problem that there's inappropriate inflammation that's damaging tissues, a sort of autoimmune process, and that's going across many diseases. And so if you want to get at the root cause of what is making that disease happen, then we want to get back to making the mitochondria more efficient and more effective again. And then you want to get at reducing the toxin load in the body, and then reducing that inappropriate inflammation, because that's often tied to food sensitivities or mold sensitivities. And what we discover is if we start looking at those biochemical processes and the cellular processes, and we fix those in ways that we can through lifestyle changes, we discover that all these chronic, many, you know, these hundreds of different chronic diseases that share these pathways all begin to improve. That the most effective treatment doesn't really depend on understanding the traditional diagnosing that I do in my internal medicine type practice. It really depends on the functional medicine diagnosing that I do for my environmental issues, they're at the root cause of nearly every chronic disease.
And that's such a paradigm shift we are in the midst of, and part of the leading edge, so to speak, is understanding that conditions are just results of the system being impaired in some way or other.
Correct. You know, in my therapeutic lifestyle clinic that I run now at the VA, we take all comers, all sorts of complex chronic problems, many autoimmune, but not, certainly not all. So these people come in. I look at their drug list, make sure I know if I have to worry about drug nutrient reactions. And then I do it the little timeline, but it focuses on helping them address the toxins in their bodies, their nutrient deficiencies, because they all have poor diets. I teach them how to resuscitate their mitochondria. And so it's the same intervention for these seven people that we see with their different disease names, but it's really the same diet and lifestyle interventions, and they all steadily improve because it's diet and lifestyle that will get to the root cause of the reason most of these people develop their illness.
So this is a good place. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about what you need to know if you have MS or fibromyalgia or Parkinson's disease or Hashimoto's thyroiditis or rheumatoid arthritis or whatever the issue may be. Stay tuned, because we're going to give you some clues so you can help to repair, regenerate, and rejuvenate your body. So this is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know with my guest today, Dr. Terry Wells, and we will be right back. Hi, we're back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're having such an interesting conversation with Dr. Terry Walls, who's the author of The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine. So your story is like every person's story, isn't it, Terry? I mean, we're all so much exposed to toxins and nutritional deficiencies and stress, and our culture, we've created this wonderful 21st century society, but we have paid the price, and it's showing up in the huge statistics of people dealing with all these chronic illnesses. And you have found your way through your own challenge, and I thought you might want to share some of the key principles or concepts that you've incorporated into your protocol. And also, we talked about before we started the show that you are getting a lot of inquiries from people dealing with fibromyalgia and Parkinson's. So maybe, you know, we can address it. I don't know if it's, you know, if it's other than what we already are talking about and what needs to be done, but we need to let people know that these also can be healed.
Yes, yes. So the base that everyone needs to address is we have to flood ourselves with the building blocks they need to conduct the chemistry of life properly. And so I use the medical science to identify the 19 nutrients that I know that are critical for a healthy, happy brain cell. And then we designed a diet using paleo principles, and I give enough structure so that when people follow this diet, they can feel very confident they're getting the things their cells need. So that means, and this is for a man or a 6-foot-tall woman, if you're a petite woman, you'll need proportionately less. So it's 9 cups of vegetables and fruit. It's 3 cups of green leaves, 3 cups of sulfur-rich vegetables in the cabbage, onion, mushroom family, and 3 cups of deeply colored, so beets, carrots, berries. And this can be raw or cooked. High-quality protein. And so I've written a vegetarian-vegan version, although I do make it clear that I would prefer people have animal protein. And then I exclude, because of the risk of food sensitivities, gluten-containing grains, wheat, rye, barley, dairy, and that's because the amino acid sequence in gluten and dairy are close enough that if you're sensitive to one, you're probably sensitive to the other. And we also exclude eggs. We do that because Eggs are often another unrecognized source of food sensitivity. That's the level one. And then we talk about the importance of reducing stress, some type of daily stress-reducing activity such as meditation, mindfulness, Epsom salts bath, prayer, journaling. And I talk about the wide variety, simply encouraging that doing that on a regular basis every day is profoundly helpful. And then the importance of moving our body. Our ancestors expected us to move 3 to 9 miles a day. And we need to have physical activity again. And because in my condition, and for many people who are severely debilitated, neuromuscular electrical stimulation will help accelerate the development of more muscle strength and endurance if you add the electrical stimulation to the exercise program.
You know, Terry, I don't know what that is. Can you explain that a little
sure.
bit more?
So you put electrodes that are sticky on the surface of the skin, and you locate them over the muscle, over what we call the motor points, and use a small electrical current that will go through the skin. It will contract the muscle, and at the same time the muscle is contracting, we instruct the individual to also contract the muscle. And so you hold it for 10 seconds and then relax for 20 seconds. And we designed a exercise program and an electrotherapy program specific to that person's exercise capabilities, given their level of disability.
So combining some form of movement to help support those muscles to
Correct.
Remember to function.
Correct. This is being studied in in stroke patients and in spinal cord injury patients. Long history in the use of athletes to help them recover from their injuries more quickly. People are just now beginning to study it in clinical disease states as well. Mm. And I'm one of the first people studying it in the setting of multiple sclerosis.
And is it a portable system that people can use?
Yeah, the device I have is a Continuum. I have a link to that device on my website, terrywallace.com. And we have some of our papers there that people can look at to see how we're using the device in our studies.
So when people come to you or people listening are diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, and, you know, we were also saying earlier that not everyone is diagnosed officially, but mm-hmm. still have indications that they are...
they're suffering, and they have autoantibodies.
Right, have autoantibodies. So maybe we can just explain that a bit so people understand when we talk about an autoimmune disease,
sure.
what that is.
So the term autoimmunity means that the immune cells are attacking the self and damaging the self, my own organ tissues like my joints, my brain, my liver, kidneys, skin, lungs, and creating a lot of damage. And what will happen is you'll have symptoms for years, sometimes decades, before lab tests start showing up abnormal. And that first you'll have some autoantibodies that can be measured, but there may not be enough damage to have a particular diagnosis. For example, they may tell you that you have a positive anti-nuclear antibody test, but there's not enough damage yet to say you have lupus. And so you have to wait for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 more years, and finally there's enough damage that your doctor can say, well, yes, you have lupus, and now I can offer you these kinds of drugs.
And what are your thoughts as to why certain areas of the body, certain parts of the body, start being attacked by one's own, antibodies?
So this is a concept I'm going to talk about is molecular mimicry. I had an infection sometime earlier in my life that the virus or bacteria, in an effort to hide from my immune cells, evolved an amino acid sequence that looks like my myelin, the insulation of my brain. Mm. So my body did not attack that virus or bacteria to clear it. But eventually I got sick enough that my body did start attacking that virus or bacteria and cleared the infection, but unfortunately continued to attack structures that look similar to that, which in my case happens to be the myelin in my spinal cord and brain. So, you know, part of the theory is our bacteria and viruses learn to hide by looking like part of our organ structures. And if we're not able to fully eradicate that infection quickly, a chronic infection may develop that also leads us to begin attacking similar-looking structures in our body.
So, and that can happen anywhere, in any structure of our body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why we have, I believe, over 300 different autoimmune conditions.
You know, in every year, we're adding more. There's the confirmed autoimmune, possible autoimmune. I believe some of the latest science is now saying atherosclerosis is an autoimmune condition, and that high blood pressure is autoimmune. As we read that schizophrenia and autism are being labeled now as probable autoimmune. So this is a rapidly evolving field, and likely more and more and more of our disease states will be deemed autoimmune.
So what you are helping people to understand is how to work with the diet and some key nutritionals that can restore these key functions that have been impaired. And it's not just one. It's like the whole system is down, so to speak, and
right.
They need to be revived. And we need to understand that this is a new way of life for us. It's not something it's not like taking
right.
a medication for a period of time and you're never magically better anyway. But
well,
it's not something that goes away without constant tending.
So, you know, people ask me, am I cured? I'm certainly not cured. I'm not going to use that word. I'm vastly better. You know, I can walk easily. I can bike easily. I can walk, jog in the treadmill now. A year and a half ago, I accidentally was given some gluten in a restaurant. They served me this wonderful soup. I ate it. They came out and said, whoops, we're sorry that what we gave you had gluten in it. So 48 hours later, I had horrific face pain, more neurologic problems, and had to take high-dose steroids to get through that. So if I deviate from my dietary protocols, I will develop symptoms, typically of pain, and I may have some other symptoms as well. So I'm very, very careful about what I eat and what I do. If I quit meditating, I can tell I'm not feeling as much energy and I'm not doing as well either. So I have learned now to pay a great deal of attention to my diet and lifestyle so that I can have the fullest energy and do the best possible.
Because these vulnerabilities are there and they're present and will continue to be there. So as long as you are not doing things that are going to aggravate inflammation or create excessive toxicity in your body is happily able to function. But as soon as you add some sort of stressor into your life, then you feel the consequences of that.
Correct. So keep up my good diet. I'm doing well. If I avoid the foods to which I'm sensitive, I do well. Maintain my stress-reducing activities, I do well. And I'm very committed to continuing my exercise and training, and I'm hopeful that at some point I'll be able to run and mountain bike again.
Right. You know, it's like a blessing and a curse, because you can't stray very far off the straight and narrow, but the benefit of that is, and as many people do stray off but don't understand what they're compromising, for you, you're so sensitive, when you do, it shows up right away, but it just encourages you to stay on the straight and narrow, which we all really need to do, but we don't all have the urgency and the immediate feedback from our bodies, or we're not paying attention to it.
I would let the listeners know that until I had completely cleaned out my diet, 100% meticulously clear, and had been clean like that for several months, then when I ate something incorrectly, then I could really tell, and I do not like how that feels. But you have to be completely clean for several months in order to appreciate that difference. If you're only 70% or 90% or 95% good on the diet, you're not clean enough. You'll have to be completely clean for several months to be able to appreciate this.
So you can have toxic exposure, but you're still toxic enough that you're not going to have that distinction. You're not going to notice it because you're kind of in that.
You still have a high level of inflammation going on in your body.
Yeah, you get
used
to it.
So you really clean out that and let that inflammation completely calm down. You can't perceive the big jump.
Right.
Now, because there's so little inflammation in my body, when I have something to which I have an adverse reaction, it's a big jump. It's very noticeable. And I'm very grateful for it because that's allowed me to learn how to create this protocol and be very attentive to it. Had I not had this big reaction, I would have never put all this together.
You know, I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of the risks for people dealing or choosing to have a vegetarian or even more restrictive vegan diet that
sure.
they may need to be aware of if they're going to follow that pattern, that diet protocol.
Well, so I see a lot of vegetarians and vegans who simply remove animal products out of their diet, remove meat or remove all animal products out of their diet, and aren't attentive to be sure that they're getting sufficient protein and sufficient nutrient density to get their vitamins and minerals. So I see vegetarian vegans who are still eating a lot of white sugar, white flour, no vegetables, and no sources of protein. They will develop a chronic health problem. B12 needs intrinsic factor to be absorbed, and the intrinsic factor is designed to interact with animal forms of B12. And so the vegetarian vegan who is not aware of that and not taking supplemental B12 will develop deterioration in the proprioception or the position sensing parts of their nervous system, and then more extensive deterioration of the nervous system, and will have what will look very much like an autoimmune multiple sclerosis type illness. They'll also be at risk to have not enough protein on hand, and protein is very important for healthy immune cells, healthy brain cell function as well. And, of course, anyone who's not eating many fruits and vegetables in fat, butter, cod liver oil, fat sources of fat-soluble vitamins for A, K, and E will begin to have problems as well. So there are many potential difficulties. A wise vegetarian who understands about the B12 and the B complex will be at less risk, but they still have a lot of carbs in their diet, so they may still be at risk for having an overgrowth of yeast. But I tell people in the book, if they are ideal body weight, in terrific health, and they are on top of the B12 protein and really are eating lots of vegetables, then they may have figured out a very effective pattern for them, and there's no need to change. But if they have an autoimmune problem, a chronic health problem, a mental health problem, and they're vegetarian, their diet may well have been a significant factor in why they developed that illness. And then we talk about strategies they can do to address that, either by reintroducing meat or things they can do as a vegetarian and vegan to correct the nutritional deficiencies that they've likely set up.
What's your favorite protein option for vegetarians and vegans?
Well, I would have them sprout their grain and bean sources to soak it 24 hours, wash that. That will take out the anti-nutrients. And so I think that is a very, very helpful option.
You know, I'm a recovering vegetarian. I totally understand what you're talking about because I was one of those very uneducated vegetarians, and I think that's the key. If you're going to choose a vegetarian or a vegan lifestyle, you really need to be educated about what nutrients you're most likely to be deficient in so you can replenish it. And I didn't know that. So, you know, that's when all these health issues started to show up, with including the Hashimoto's and chronic hay fever and some arthritis and then adrenal exhaustion. It was quite a revelation because I was doing this diet, which I had done for 20 years as well, thinking it was a healthy diet, but in the end it was deteriorating my health the way I was doing it. So I had to change and brought protein back in and understood mm-hmm. the role of protein for rebuilding my body. So I had to, you know, I had to rethink things because ultimately my body was not very happy.
Correct. Now, I do have one of my members of my study team is a vegetarian for religious reasons. And so I am sympathetic that there are vegetarians and vegans who are, for their spiritual reasons and religious reasons, not going to eat meat. But I want them to know how to do it in a safer way that's less likely to cause adverse health consequences.
Right, and that's the point. It's, you know, people have to make their choices, but you just want to be sure that you are covering all bases nutritionally so you don't get into trouble down the track.
Correct. You know? Correct.
So in the time we have remaining, you've been incorporating your protocol into the clinic that you work with at the VA there in Iowa.
Yes.
With traumatic brain injury people and getting great success. Do you want to just share a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. You know, traumatic brain injury, a huge problem, 1.5 million traumatic brain injuries every year. And fortunately, the majority are mild, but even the mild can end up with chronic neurobehavioral problems, psychiatric problems. And typically, the advice is to just treat them psychiatrically as best they can. And while the research says nutrition in the acute injury when someone's comatose is very important, no one's been talking about the critical role of nutrition for traumatic brain injury long term. In my clinic, I came on board and said, oh, no, this is, we can do a lot for people with mild and moderate traumatic brain injury by teaching them diet and lifestyle. You know, it's the same principle. You flood the cells with the key nutrients that the brain cells need. Take away, I still encourage many of my traumatic brain injury folks to spend at least a month taking gluten, dairy out and then reintroducing it to see if they are sensitive or not. I also talk about the critical role of exercise. We check the vitamin D and the homocysteine and correct those things. What I see time and time again is that when people really get on board with the 9 cups of vegetables, meat to appetite, that their energy improves, their mental clarity improves, their social skills begin improving again, that it's so much easier to get along with their family and their coworkers. I have many, many veterans telling me that adopting the diet has saved their life, has saved their family life, has saved their work life. Because without diet and lifestyle, the only treatment that's offered to traumatic brain injury survivors is if you've got a psychiatric problem, we'll give you the psych drugs. The psych drugs will never improve processing speed. It will never improve your memory or your focus. It won't help you get your social skills back so you can get along with your family and your coworkers again. To do that, you have to regrow those brain cell connections. And to do that, you have to have all the building blocks, which comes down to, you know, 9 cups of fruits and vegetables, grass-fed meat, wild fish. I'm a big fan of organ meat and seaweed as well. And it's doing a marvelous job for our veterans to get them fired up about diet and lifestyle.
Well, what's really exciting is not only seeing how many people can actually improve with traumatic brain injury, which, as you said, there really isn't a lot of hope in the traditional allopathic model. But really your message is, and the message of functional medicine and giving people really wholesome food, is that the body can heal and repair itself of anything. Given half a chance, all we need to do is really support it. And it's not just about the nutrient-dense food and healthy choices that you outline in your book, but it also is bringing in those lifestyle and those practices like meditation, which people totally underestimate how important meditation is for the body's capacity to heal and repair. And maybe that's just something you can mention a little bit before we have to complete our time together.
You know, in my clinical trial, we see people doing a great job on the diet, but they seem to get stuck, and they're not improving anymore. And that's when I really explore, is there unrecognized stress? And that's often what we find. And helping them finally realize they have to address the family conflict, talk things through, get back to the meditation, and get their stress-reducing activities back on track. And that's very, very helpful. I've had to face that myself, that I get busy, I quit meditating, things aren't going nearly as well. I have to really attend to the morning meditation and my afternoon meditation. I do much, much better when I do.
Because there's so much research showing that finding a meditative practice actually supports the healing energies of the body. It changes our DNA, switches genes on appropriately, and people often think nothing much is happening in 15 minutes of being quiet. But in fact, that's where the most profound things are happening. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people that that has to be the foundation of your program. That doesn't kind of come slide in and out at will. You've got to establish it because it is so critical for the body's ability to allow the benefit of all these other good things you're doing. But meditation is just key.
Yes, yeah. I think it's very important. When you have a chronic health problem, you want to do is tackle every one of your lifestyle behaviors and gradually nudge them towards a health-promoting behavior. So we get a more nutrient-dense diet. We help people identify the stress-reducing activities that resonate with who they are, and so they can begin doing them. And then we help them design their exercise program. And that's what I do in my clinics. We help them get a more nutrient-dense diet. We help them identify what their stress-reducing activity is going to be and help them set their goals for how they're going to move their bodies.
Yes, and it's your story is so powerful because it demonstrates what is possible when mm-hmm. we address all those factors. Is there anything else you want to share with my audience?
I think we should tell your listeners to go visit terrywalls.com. We have a bunch of downloads that they can get from the book because we talked about a lot of free resources in the book that will help them get started. They could go find me on Facebook under Terry Walls, MD. And my Twitter is Dr. Terry Walls.
And we need to make sure people spell it correctly, which is Wahls for Walls.
Yes.
So,
and TerryWahls.
And I really encourage people to pick up a copy of your fantastic book, The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine. Well, this has been such a pleasure, Terry. I just wish you all the best, and I know that you are having a huge influence in bringing about a culture change in the world of medicine because of who you are and what you have demonstrated in your life and the amount of rigorous research you have put into demonstrating, proving everything that you have been working with. So I personally want to thank you because you're making a difference to so many people all around the world. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you all for listening. This is why I love doing these shows. We bring in amazing people. I get inspired. I trust you're getting inspired and also learning. And you can appreciate after this conversation with Dr. Terry Walls today how you have been given clues, important clues, profound clues to support your health to help you heal, or certainly to make sure you stay on a healthy track. So hope you'll be visiting with me again next week. And remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.